thank you very much, Martin. So this will be a Blackboard talk, but before I turn to the board, I show you a few slides that I have stolen from the CERN propaganda webpage, just to give you an idea about what we are talking about. So this is here a picture of Geneva. So you can see here Lake Geneva, and here the airport in Geneva. And this is the tunnel underground, the outline of the tunnel underground, where this experiment that is called the Large Hadron Collider is under construction right now. And we hope that by the end of August or maybe September, it will actually be running. Okay, so here are a few propaganda numbers. It's probably the largest machine in the world. It has 27 kilometers circumference. And probably, I think it's a good guess to say, it's probably the biggest scientific experiment ever undertaken. It has been under construction directly since 2000, and of course, in preparation for many more years before. Here's another picture of the tunnel itself when the actual accelerator ring is being installed, and some propaganda numbers about the accelerator. There will be 9,300 magnets, and they will all have to be cooled down to 1.9 Kelvin in order to accelerate the protons that will be smashed together to 7 TeV each. Okay, and it's probably one of the best vacuum that is achieved, 10 to the minus 13 atmosphere, in order to stabilize the beam. Okay, here is an underground picture of the slides of the same thing. So you can see that the whole tunnel is deep underground, and there will be four experiments where protons or heavy ions will be collided. And the two most important for us are these multipurpose experiments, which are basically just supposed to check everything that is going out after the collision. So one of them is called ATLAS, and the other one is called the CMS detector. Okay. And so here's a picture of the ATLAS detector. You can see here some people, just to see how big it is. And I lifted another picture with a random tourist from the CERN website. Okay, so actually these detectors will be really amazing because there will be 600 million collisions per second, and they will be able to have achieve an accuracy of 10 to the minus 9 seconds in timing and 10 to the minus 6 meters in accuracy of tracks. And the amount of data that will be produced is staggering. They claim that 100,000 DVDs per year will be filled with data from this. And of course, they are not even recording most of the data coming out from the LHC, because it would be so much that they wouldn't be able to handle it. Okay, here's the picture of the other detector. It's a little bit smaller, so that's why it's called the compact muon solenoid. Another tourist picture. And another staggering number is, you know, the actual energy that is stored in the proton beams. It's like a 400-ton train traveling at 150 kilometers per hour. So they better know what they do with this beam, because it's able to melt 500 kilometers of kilograms of copper. Okay, so in the end, these protons will collide. And this is a simulation of one of the more interesting events. But you can see that there are, out of one collision, there will be hundreds of tracks flying out. And it will be a really amazing achievement to be able to tell that in this particular event, there was some interesting particle that was created. And for that, again, they built these detectors. One of them is this compact muon solenoid, the CMS detector. And you can see that there are different layers of detecting materials in order to detect different kind of particles. Okay, so this much for the propaganda. And now I have to change the screen and get to the physics. Let's try it. Are you sure? Because I turned it on.
Maybe.
Good. Good. So, I need some more lights. good. So what I would like to do in this talk is to explain to you why we are building this accelerator and what is the most interesting physics that we think is going to come out of this accelerator. So for this, I would like to tell you just the very basics of particle physics for those of you who don't know much about it, namely the fact that over the last 30 years, we have understood a lot about, you know, the theory of elementary particles. We know that there are four fundamental interactions. Okay, so those are the electromagnetic, and hopefully everybody knows about that. Some of the people in the Dynamo workshop, of course, know a lot more than we do. The weak interactions, the strong interactions, and gravity. Okay, so these are the four interactions that we for sure know about. And we have a good theory describing all of these interactions. Okay, gravity is described pretty well by Einstein's theory, so that's general relativity. And gravitational interactions are actually pretty weak, so they are usually not very important for accelerator experiments. So I will be ignoring gravity in the rest of the talk. Okay, I will be focusing on these other three experiments, these other three interactions. And the first thing I would like to get through is that we have a really good theory describing these three interactions. Okay, so that's called the standard model of particle physics. And it's actually a theory that is based on the generalization of Maxwell's equations. It's a generalized Maxwell's theory. Okay, so, for example, the theory of electromagnetic and weak interactions is called the theory of unified electroweak interactions. Okay. And the main feature of this is that, like in Maxwell's theory, you usually use a gauge potential, the gauge field A mu, to describe the electromagnetic field. So you derive the E and the B field from this four-vector potential. You will have analog fields describing the weak interactions. So there will be another version of the photon, which is called the Z and the W particles. And these particles are the objects that are giving rise to the force of the weak interactions. Okay, so the W is, of course, the force-carrying particle of the weak interactions. That's why they call it the W particle. And then people realize, well, there is actually another one, so they needed to come up with another letter, so they call it the Z. Okay, so the point is that these weak interactions, they really work just like the electromagnetic interactions, except instead of one photon, there are three others. And the main difference is that these guys actually are massive. Okay, so that's why the weak interactions are weaker than the electromagnetic one, because the force-carrying particle is massive, so there will be just a finite range to the weak interactions. Okay, so these guys are massive. But otherwise, it is another theory like the Maxwell's theory. Okay. And the strong interactions, it turns out, are fundamentally also described by another generalized Maxwell's theory, which is called the theory of quantum chromodynamics. So there are another type of force-carrying particles, which are called the gluons. Okay, and this is the theory that is called the QCD, quantum chromodynamics. And that's the theory which basically was discovered by David Gross and his collaborators in 73. Okay? So there are these kind of force-carrying particles, and they give rise to the elementary forces among the matter particles. And we distinguish usually two kinds of matter particles. They are called the leptons, and they are called the hadrons. Okay, the two different kinds. And the main difference between them is...
So QCD came out of accelerator experiments? So there was sort of an observational factor that was...
So people knew that there are strong interactions, yes? And then, for a long time, they couldn't quite understand how to describe it in the same language as before. But then in the late 60s, there was an accelerator experiment at SLAC, actually, that discovered a property that was called scaling. Okay. And that actually led people to understand what kind of theory they need to describe the strong interactions. So it was based originally on these SLAC MIT deep inelastic scattering experiments in the late 60s. And then, of course, there are many other tests now of QCD in accelerators. So we know pretty well that this is really the right theory of strong interactions. Okay. Any other questions? So there are these two kinds of particles, the leptons, and those are the ones that only feel the electroweak interactions. So they don't feel the strong interactions. And the hadrons, which feel the strong interactions. Okay. It turns out that those are actually all bound states of more fundamental objects, the so-called quarks. Okay. Of course, you know, this quark theory was also an important ingredient of establishing, you know, the right theory of QCD. Okay, and that came out mostly by trying to classify the different bound states that people have seen in the 50s. Okay, so what I would like to just emphasize about it, that we do have a really good theory that describes these elementary particles, their interactions, and this is called the standard model, and we have tested the standard model to unprecedented precision in the 90s. So the standard model is very well tested. In fact, it's tested to about 0.1% level precision. Okay. So it's not a question whether or not this model is right. It is the right model. Okay. So these tests, actually, the most successful ones were carried through exactly in the same tunnel where the LHC is now going to be built. It was also at CERN in the lab experiment. Okay, which was running from the late 80s to about, I think, 2001. Okay, and there we were smashing together electrons and positrons. So LEP stands for the Large Electron Positron Collider. Okay, and we have been directly producing millions of these force-mediating Z bosons and have studied the property of these Z bosons and also W bosons in great detail. And so things like E plus E minus generating a Z boson, this force-carrying particle decaying to mu plus E minus or quarks. And we have measured many properties of the Z boson to extreme precision. And we have found that the standard model is describing this theory really well. Yes?
Does the standard model allow magnetic monopoles?
The standard model itself doesn't, but if you think that the standard model is embedded into a bigger theory, then many of those versions will give you a magnetic monopole. So if there is grand unification, for example, then you would get stable magnetic monopole. Okay, very good. So the upshot is that we measured all of these quantities, things like, again, the mass of the Z, the width of the Z, you know, cross sections of generating different type of final state particles, and they are all in great agreement with the standard model.
Just to be clear,
yes.
The sort of tests and precision you speak of are generally things like Branson ratios.
Exactly. Yeah. As I say, things like, you know, the mass of the Z boson, the width, the total width of the Z boson, the total cross section of generating, you know, hadrons in this setup, and then the different branching fractions of the Z itself. And then, so originally they started out at energies very close to the mass of the Z, and then they went slowly up in energies to about 200 GeV, which is about 200 times the mass of the proton. And then they checked, you know, other possible intermediate states. So there are about 20-some quantities that are known to roughly this 0.1% precision. Okay. Things like forward, backward asymmetries in cross sections, left-right asymmetries.
But precision, you mean accuracy.
Yeah.
Precision is a measurement procedure.
Yeah, this is.
Accuracy should be compared to the theory.
Yeah, so again, this is the precision of the measurement. And then, of course, you make predictions by the standard model itself. And you find that out of these 25 quantities, everything is within 2 sigma, except maybe one quantity is 2.5 sigma away. That's my remembrance of the actual result. Okay, so the theory is really well established, except there is one which is theoretically probably the most and conceptually the most interesting and maybe also the most disturbing part of this theory, namely the generation of mass in these theories. So the only sector that is completely untested which is how masses are actually generated in the standard model. That will be exactly the main topic of this talk, you know, the issue of electroweak symmetry breaking. So what does this question even mean, how masses are generated within the standard model? Well, what I was telling you at the very beginning is that all of the standard model is based on a generalization of Maxwell's theory, yes? And you know that in Maxwell's theory, one of the most fundamental properties of the electromagnetic field is that all the Maxwell equations are actually gauge invariant. Okay? So you can do a transformation with an arbitrary field, a gauge transformation, which will leave all your equations invariant. And you know, when you're trying to solve E&M problems, you always pick the gauge that is the most simple for you, and it doesn't matter in the end, everything will be invariant under that. Okay, and that's of course, you know, true also for all these generalized theories. It will be a little bit more complicated form because there will be another index that is telling you which of these heavy gauge bosons you are talking about, and there will be an index for the gauge transformation parameter. There's an extra term, it doesn't quite matter what it means. Okay. Important thing is that a generalization of gauge invariance does exist in all of these so-called non-abelian gauge theories. And that will also forbid the mass of not just the photon, but also the Z and the W, and it turns out also for all these matter particles. Okay, so all the matter particles and the Z and the W should be massless. All particles should be massless. But obviously, I told you already at the beginning, they are not. The W and the Z are really heavy versions of the photon. They are weighing about 80 or 90 times the mass of the proton itself. Okay, so that's sort of a contradiction. And
so how do you see that out of the theory? Is that just because they...
Oh, so the point is that, you know, a mass term would look like A mu, A nu. Okay, that's how, it's a quadratic term in the gauge field itself, okay? And clearly, this term, you know, if I do this transformation on it, will not remain invariant, so it would break your gauge symmetry, okay? Just like, you know, in the case of the photon, yes, you know what, you know, you have to write down everything in terms of F mu nu that has derivatives in it. It's not a pure mass term. The photon is just a massless propagating particle, okay? Okay, so somehow something has to break the symmetry. Okay, so that's the key issue. That the electroweak symmetry we think is an exact symmetry of the action, but it's not a symmetry of the vacuum itself. The electroweak symmetry has to be spontaneously broken. Okay, so what does that mean? A simple way of thinking about it is that, yes, really all these particles are in fact massless, but they are actually not propagating through a simple vacuum, but through a complicated vacuum that acts like a medium that is slowing down the propagation of these particles. Okay, so the masses are picked up by a propagation through medium. Okay.
Is that true not only for W and Z, but all the leptons?
So that's also true for all the leptons and all the quarks. Okay, basically all the particles in the standard model. I mean, for experts, there is another source of mass just from strong interactions, but for now, I will just, you know, that would give rise to masses of the hadrons, but not to the W, the Z, and the leptons. Okay, so that's a, you know, that's a pretty strong assumption, and it's actually difficult to do it, yes, because propagation through a medium kind of means that there is something like the ether around, yes? And we know that that theory leads to big problems with relativity. So what we have to postulate is that there is a medium filling all of space that actually looks the same in every reference frame. Okay? So it has to be actually relativistically invariant medium. Otherwise, you know, it's clearly excluded already. Every reference frame should look the same. Nevertheless, it should fill all of space. Okay, so there's only one kind of particle that could do that, one kind of field, which is a scalar field. The scalar field means that it looks the same in every reference frame. Okay, so if this story, this crazy sounding story, is true, then there has to exist a scalar field. Okay, scalar field again just means that if I do a Lorentz transformation on it, it will look this, it will won't pick up any you know non-trivial transformation. Okay, so that's why the particle physicists are postulating that there is on top of all of these fields there's another particle which is called the Higgs scalar. So it doesn't itself carry quantum numbers under relativity transformations, which we call Lorentz transformations, but it carries charges under these electro-weak interactions. Okay, and then this medium is actually Lorentz invariant in the sense that, you know, when you do a boost, it won't change at all, but it is not invariant in the from the point of view of which direction out of these internal electroweak symmetries it is picking out. Okay? So within this sort of gauge space, within the space of the electroweak interactions, it will pick a preferred frame. Okay? And that's why particles can pick up a mass. Or at least so we think. Okay, so it will pick a preferred direction. In the internal electroweak space. Okay. So this is a theory that doesn't violate Lorentz, you know, Einstein's theory of relativity. Nevertheless, has this weird field that gives you this medium through which the particles, when they propagate, they you know, will pick up a mass. So the way we are imagining it is that there's this Higgs field, okay, and it has to carry quantum numbers, has to carry charge under these electroweak interactions. So we call this actually a doublet under the electroweak interactions. Okay, so again, this is a doublet in this internal space where the W and the Z bosons are acting like the photon. And then this scalar field will have a non-trivial potential, which we call a Mexican head potential. Okay, so the way this potential would look like is something like this. Okay, and it has, this is a complex field, so it's actually a multidimensional potential. You should really think of this as slides here. And this potential is such that this Higgs field, the vacuum expectation value, will not be sitting at the origin. Okay, It will not be sitting at zero because that is not the lowest energy ground state, but it's at some non-trivial value. And saying that you are sitting at this non-trivial value here from the origin is the source of electroweak symmetry breaking. Okay, that's like saying that I have a magnet and then I have a ferromagnetic state, which will pick a preferred direction, even though your theory of magnets is a completely rotationally invariant system. Okay, so the theory itself is completely invariant under these transformations, but once you say that your vacuum is actually sitting at this particular point and not at that point, that's what is the breaking of the symmetry. Okay? And what is amazing is that actually, when you try to write down the theory of these scalars that are interacting with the gauge field, then among those terms that you are generating, there will be a term of this form. Okay? So the interaction with the Higgs field will contain this term, and once this field gets an expectation value that is non-zero, that will effectively look like a mass term. So once I just put in the vacuum expectation value for this Higgs scalar, this will effectively look like a mass term for the photon or the generalized W and Z bosons themselves. Okay.
Whoa, you just said a mass term for the photon. That makes me feel cautious.
Again. So that's very important. And what we have is, so we have a bigger theory that contains both the photon and the W and the Z boson. Okay. And what you can show is that with this potential, there will be a single gauge boson that remains massless, and three will pick up a mass. Okay. And of course, which one it is, you know, that's not predetermined. That depends on which direction you're putting your web. But there's always one that is massless. Okay? And whatever is massless is the one that you will be calling the photon. Okay?
So the way you've drawn this picture, if this is a rotational symmetry there, I mean, there's no energy in going around.
Exactly.
So there's no barrier in that direction.
So there is no barrier in this direction, yes. And so that is what you would, okay, so this is a little bit more for experts. This is the direction that you would normally call a Goldstone boson. Okay? And actually the interaction of this Goldstone boson with the gauge field is really what will make it possible for you to give a mass to the gauge field. So this Goldstone boson, this direction, will actually secretly become a part of the gauge field itself. And that's what people usually call the Higgs mechanism.
Say, how do you guarantee that Maxwell photon will be massless?
I have to pick a theory of this breaking and the potential such that one of the directions is unbroken. Okay, so this is not guaranteed ahead of time.
Which one?
That's not guaranteed ahead of time. Okay, so that depends on what kind of charges I pick, what kind of gauge group I pick, what kind of charges I pick for the field that is going to get a vacuum expectation value. I can give you many wrong theories that will not give you a massless photon. Yes, there are many, many possible theories that at first sight seem to be close to what we want, but then they are not right. Okay, and there are some that do give you a massless photon. Okay, so in particular the one that is the standard model has an SU2 cross U1 gauge group, okay, but this is not the U1 for electromagnetism itself, and then this is just broken down to U1. Okay. So what I'm trying to say is that if you have a Higgs with a certain quantum number, that will guarantee you that there is not enough fields here to give a mass to all the gauge boson. Okay. So there will be one always left massless. If you had more than one Higgs, or more than one Higgs with one kind of quantum numbers, you could also break electromagnetism, okay? And of course, you know, we just say that theory is not the right theory describing nature, okay?
Why did you pick a quantic interaction than a cubic?
Okay, so what I, the way I, this has been picked is, well, first of all, I want to write it such that...
No, the interaction with the A-mu.
Oh. Okay, so that is actually coming out from trying to write down all the gauge invariant interaction of the scalar field with the gauge field. Okay. So
why couldn't that be just H A V A U?
So again, you know, this is not a term on its own in the Lagrangian. This is really writing in an elaborate way a gauge invariant version of the kinetic term of the scalar field.
This term gives a mass.
This term gives a mass, yes. Yeah. But again, you know, it is actually coming from something more complicated. It is this on its own would not be gauge invariant itself. It's part of several terms which together are gauge invariant, and once you know, this is one of those many terms, and this will give rise to a mass.
Kinetic energy is a quadratic.
Exactly, that's the point. That this is really coming from the kinetic energy of the scalar field made gauge invariant. Yes.
I'll ask the question you didn't ask. Is it certain that for some unknown symmetry, lambda is not zero, and that next order term is not quadratic?
So whether there's any higher order term here?
Well,
okay, so the higher order term, zero. We are just assuming yeah. that this theory is so-called renormalizable theory for now. Okay, so we're only writing down the renormalizable operators, the ones that would be relevant anyway at low energies. If there's a higher order term here, because of renormalization group running, those will not be important anyway.
Even if lambda is zero?
Well, if lambda is zero, that's of course, that would be a problem, but, so we just postulate that it's not zero. Okay, actually the mass of, I will come to the Higgs boson itself, is proportional to this lambda. So we know it's not zero. Okay, so what I want to also say is that not only does the photon or the, you know, the W and the Z pick up a mass, but the same way, via other interactions of the matter fields with the Higgs boson, those will also be allowed to pick up a mass. Okay, so the picture is really, you know, very naive picture of this electroweak symmetry breaking is such that there is this medium filling all of space. Yes, and depending on how strongly the different particles interact with this medium, this Higgs field, yes, they will propagate with different velocities in this medium. Okay, so the photon, again, because of these choices of quantum numbers, it doesn't fill the medium at all. It doesn't couple to the medium, so it will just zoom through and will still remain a massless particle. The electron, which is the lightest particle in the standard model, that for us just means it has a very weak coupling to this medium, so it will propagate, but every now and then it will bump into this medium and it will be slowed down a little bit. The top quark, which is the heaviest known particle, it will bump every second, it will bump a lot, so it will be slowed down a lot, so that's how it is gaining a lot of mass. Okay, so this is the theory of electroweak interactions, of electroweak symmetry breaking. So now how could we validate that? Okay, obviously it sounds like a nice fairy tale, but the point is that if all of this is true and this medium exists, then this field itself will have its own excitations. And somebody already asked me, there will be excitations on the bottom of the potential. Okay, so those actually become part of the gauge field itself. So more or less, we know they are there. But there is one that would be an entirely new particle, which would be the radial excitation of this Higgs scalar. Okay, so this is what we call the Higgs boson itself. Okay, so the key is to search for the Higgs boson. Okay, so this is what most particle physicists would like to do. And of course, as I said, we don't know actually how heavy this Higgs boson is. That depends on how steep this potential goes up from its minimum. So that actually depends very crucially on this quartic self-interaction itself. Okay, so the Higgs boson mass is proportional to this quartic self-interaction. Not the mass of the boson itself. What we can read is the value of this van. Okay, so that we can read from the masses of the other particles. But how heavy this guy is, that really depends on the steepness of this potential, and that's the quartic. Including, of course, it also depends on the web, but there's another free parameter that doesn't come up anywhere else. Okay, so we don't know how heavy this Higgs boson is. What we do know is that it's not very light, okay, because obviously the previous experiment that I told you was looking for, you know, validating the standard model, was also searching for the Higgs boson itself. And so when you collide electron and positron, you generated all these Z bosons. And of course, since the Z is bumping into this, you know, into this background a lot, there will be a reasonably big probability for it to actually emit the Higgs boson itself. So this would be a process that you could search just in E plus E minus collisions, and it has not been found. Okay, so that tells you that this Higgs boson, if it exists, is so heavy that this final state is kinematically not allowed. Okay, so this, the final energy of these collisions was about 210 GeV at LAP. Okay, and we know that this guy is about 90 GeV. So there's a bound of about 110 GeV, 115 GeV on this Higgs boson. The exact bound is, it's bigger than about 114 GeV. Okay, so this is what we know. It's not below that. Okay. Now, so the LHC is going to search for this particle. How it is going to search turns out to be crucially sensitive to the mass of the Higgs boson itself. Yes. Because we know that the heavier a particle is, the more strongly the Higgs boson is going to interact with it. Yes. But if the Higgs boson is actually itself not heavy enough to produce a particular final state, then it will, even though its interaction is smaller with some lighter particles, it will be just kinematically forced to decay into those lighter objects. Okay, so if the Higgs boson mass is less than twice the mass of the Z or the W, yes, then of course the heaviest available particle would be a B quark. Okay, so the Higgs would be mostly decaying to a B quark. But this is actually really not a good channel to search for, because there will be a lot of B quarks generated just from these QCD strong interaction processes. So instead, in this channel, what happens is, for these mass ranges, that for very few fraction of the time, it will also decay into photons. Okay. And so when the Higgs is relatively light, this seems to be the most important channel for discovering the Higgs. And so what the LHC is going to do is going to measure the invariant mass of these photons that are generated in E plus E minus collisions. So this is a very rough sketch, okay? And this is the number of events. And there will be a smooth background here. And if, you know, the Higgs is there, and if it's light, then there will be a tiny, tiny little bit of a bump on top of the smooth background.
The larger the mass, the sharper is the wall of the potential?
The larger the mass, yes, the sharper the wall of the
potential. Suppose we take delta function, limit, then you give us upper limit on the mass?
So, of course, if lambda goes to, yeah. So then there would be something else going wrong, actually, in this quantum field theory. So we actually know from very basic field theory reasonings, namely unitarity, that actually this Higgs boson cannot be extremely heavy.
So what is it? I'm pushing you to try the left side of this equation.
Okay, so there are several. Okay, so there is one that says that it's basically less than 1,000 GeV or something like this. So this is from just fundamental field theory considerations, like unitarity. Okay. Now, I will write another number here that is actually a stronger bound, and that is still coming from all those very precise measurements that, you know, the previous experiment lab has made before, yes?
So in superconductivity, the Higgs boson is a composite particle, the Cooper pair.
Yes, that's right.
So if your Higgs were not fundamental, how would that affect that unitarity limit or those considerations? Does that?
So that's a very interesting question that many particle theorists are thinking about. If the Higgs itself is a composite particle or not, so that's actually would be. I will be coming to the hierarchy problem, and that would play a very important role in the hierarchy problem itself. But it would also tell you that it probably wouldn't be able to completely unitarize the scattering of these heavy gauge bosons itself. But of course, that wouldn't be a problem because there would be all these other particles around that would, you know, make this composite Higgs boson. Okay. So different theories have different kind of bounds that will mostly give you a bound on all these other particles that are around that produce the composite Higgs boson. Okay. So let me just finish the Higgs discovery. So if it's light, most likely this is the channel that we are interested in. If it's heavy enough to decay into Z bosons, okay, so then there is actually a pretty clean channel, because in that case, the Higgs can decay into two Zs, and then every now and then the two Zs would be decaying into four leptons. Okay. And so those are things that are relatively easy to pick out from this background of strong interactions. So this, in that case, if MH is greater than about 2MZ, this would be the best discovery channel. Okay. Now, how about this thing that I didn't write here? So the theoretical bounds are about a TeV, but there is a stronger experimental bound on the possible upper value of the Higgs boson. Okay, and that's, again, just by these electroweak precision measurements at lab. I told you that many of these measurements have a precision of the level of 0.1%. Okay, it turns out that this is actually such a precise measurement that even though you would never have directly produced the Higgs boson, quantum effects that include so-called virtual Higgs bosons would even be observable in that case as well. Okay, so it turns out if the Higgs boson is too heavy, namely heavier than, let's say, 300 GeV, or, you know, it depends on your taste. Some people say 200 GeV, 300. I don't want to be very precise about it. But if it's very heavy, then actually the agreement that I told you of these 20 some observables with the experimental, with the theoretical predictions would not be that good anymore. Okay, so there is actually another upper bound that let's call it 300 GeV. Some people would say it's 200, but it's fluctuating so much that it's really not wise to put a precise number here. It's a few hundred GeV, but certainly much less than the theoretical upper bound. Okay, so
I don't understand. Wouldn't that be a lower bound?
It turns out that that you actually need some of the corrections of the Higgs. Without the corrections of the Higgs, you would not be able to explain it. So somehow, indirectly, people say that indirectly you have already seen that it should be.
Other particles like super.
Of course, it could be other particles. We don't know. With the assumption that it's just the standard model, yes, you would need a light Higgs. It could be, you know, other particles maybe, but. Okay, very good. So this is the story of the Higgs itself, and as I hopefully convince you, we think that we will be discovering the Higgs at the LHC. However, the Higgs itself is very confusing. So I told you we need it, because otherwise we don't understand why the electroweak symmetry is broken, but if it exists, it gives us headaches itself. And the reason is something that is called the hierarchy problem. And as I told you, the Higgs doesn't only have interactions directly with particles, but it can also have interactions with virtual excitations coming out from the vacuum. So one possible interaction like this would involve virtual excitations of fermions, for example, the top quark, and I picked this one because this is the heaviest particle, and this gives you the largest correction. And that would actually give a large correction to the mass of the Higgs boson. How large? Well, as large as you think these particles can fluctuate in the vacuum. So if this is, you know, a very high scale, for example, the scale of quantum gravity, you would expect this correction to be of the order, for example, of the scale of the Planck scale, which is many, many orders of magnitude bigger than the Wieck scale. Okay, to give you a pretty nice analogy that I heard recently, this problem is, you know, you can think of it as saying that I have a heat bath here, and this heat bath is, let's say, you know, 10 to the 16 times the electroweak scale. Okay, so it's at a very, very high temperature. There are all these particles flying around. They have very high velocity. And there is a guy, let's say our Higgs boson, coming in with a very low energy, okay, which is m electroweak. Okay? Then it interacts with all these particles in the heat bath, yes? And after it comes out, it happens to still have energy compared to its initial energy. Okay, is it possible? Sure, it's possible, but it's very, very unlikely that after interacting with all of these extremely energetic particles, it won't be picking up, you know, energy that is comparable to all the particles within this heat bath. Okay, so this is actually a pretty precise analogy to, you know, this problem that we are calling the hierarchy problem, that, you know, there are all these virtual, very energetic particles, and there's nothing that would forbid the Higgs boson to pick up a mass that is much, much higher than the electroweak itself, scale itself. Okay, so this is what we call the hierarchy problem, and that makes us hard to understand how an elementary Higgs boson can exist on its own. Okay, so obviously, most of us who are thinking about possible outcomes of the LHC are thinking about, you know, what could solve this problem. Again, this is not a contradiction with any existing experimental result, but it's a naturalness problem. Okay. Yes.
Why isn't that any different than the infinite mass renormalization of an electron in QED that, you know, we
Okay, so that's a good question. So for the electron, actually, there is a natural cutoff scale. Okay. Once you do the renormalization, it turns out that the shift in the mass of the electron is actually proportional to the electron mass itself. Okay, so if the electron mass went to zero, there would be no correction. The correction to the electron mass is proportional to the electron mass itself. And the reason for that is that there is a symmetry. When Me goes to zero, there is a new symmetry appearing, which is called the chiral symmetry, and that will forbid any generation. And for the Higgs, there is no such symmetry. So the Higgs will actually be sensitive to the highest mass scale that is present in the theory. There's nothing shielding it. Okay? For the electron, there is something shielding it from very, very high corrections to its mass. And actually the same for the gauge bosons. So the gauge boson loop corrections are proportional, obviously, to the gauge boson mass itself, since all of these can only come to electroweak symmetry breaking. Okay, there is another symmetry here. So this kind of suggests the way out also. We want a symmetry that is protecting you, your Higgs, from picking up a large mass. Okay, how can you do it? As I said, for the scalar, there is no such a symmetry. But there are other particles for which there is. If you were able to find a symmetry that is connecting the Higgs with either, you know, a version of the electron or either a gauge field, then that would be enough. Okay, so the possible solutions to the hierarchy problem would be telling you, connect the Higgs via symmetry to not necessarily the electron because it has the wrong quantum numbers, but a fermion that has the right quantum numbers. Or connect the Higgs to a gauge boson. Okay. So these are actually some of the most interesting and, you know, most strongly researched directions in particle theory phenomenology nowadays. And this first approach is called supersymmetry. And the second approach, as I will explain in a moment, leads to extraspatial dimensions. Okay. So I will just say a few words about both of these possibilities before finishing. So, as I say, in one case, I would like to get a symmetry that is connecting my elementary Higgs scalar to a fermion. So this is very different than all the other symmetries that we know about in nature, because all the other symmetries are telling you that, well, you know, there is some transformation I can do on my Lagrangian that leaves the Lagrangian invariant, but they always involve a boson transforming to a boson or a fermion transforming to a fermion. Here, this has to have a different nature. It has to transform a fermion into a boson, so that's why this is called SUSY or supersymmetry. And so if this generator of supersymmetry is acting on a boson, it will give you a fermion, or vice versa. Okay. So for those of you who actually know you a little bit about Lorentz invariants and representations of the Lorentz group, realize that, of course, you know, this is related to space-time transformation, since, you know, this is a transformation on spin. Yeah, so this has to be an extension of the Lorentz group, or the bigger version of the Lorentz group itself, of the space-time symmetries. Okay, so this is actually theoretically really exciting, because it's the biggest possible extension of space-time symmetries that can still give you a non-trivially interacting theory. Okay? And it will also solve this problem about the hierarchy, because what you will do is, for every bosonic excitation in the standard model, you will have to have a fermionic version and vice versa, and those will actually come in to the same loops that I was telling you before. So this is, let's say, the top quark, okay, and there will be the so-called super partner of this top quark, which will then regulate these large corrections. It will eliminate a large fraction of these very large corrections. Okay. There will be all these other interactions. This is now the supersymmetric version of the top quark, the stop quark, and it's actually a scalar, yes? This was a fermion, and this was a scalar. And these two together will actually give you a very small correction to the mass of the Higgs boson, not a very large one. Okay. But, of course, the upshot is that if all of this is true, then there has to be all these other new particles, which are the super partners of the standard model particles. We haven't seen a single super partner yet. And if this is true, then we would have to discover, you know, basically half of all the existing elementary particles. Okay. And the other thing is that if the masses of the super partners are greater than, let's say, a loop factor times the mass of the W boson itself, then this cancellation will be less and less precise anymore, and you will start getting into the same problem as over there. So if the mass of these super partners is very big, then you start not understanding, again, the reason for why the Higgs could have remained light enough. So these guys cannot be extremely heavy. Okay, so people think that if these guys are much more than 1 TeV, then again you will lose the explanation for why you postulated the existence of all these particles to begin with. And so if they really solve this problem, then they should be within the reach of the LHC itself. Okay. And one other cool thing about the super partners is that they actually, the lightest of them, will very likely turn out to be a stable particle. Lightest super partner is likely stable. So that will tell you, first of all, how to look for this particle, and it could also explain the dark matter problem. So this could be a dark matter candidate. Okay? Of course, assuming that it's electrically neutral and doesn't carry a color charge, could be a dark matter candidate. And not only could it be a dark matter candidate, but if you actually take this proposal seriously, very seriously, you can calculate how much of this dark matter would be around now. It turns out that you actually naturally get the right order of magnitude to account for about the an order one fraction of the critical density in the universe today. Okay, so this is a really nice prediction of supersymmetric theories. Okay. We are pretty excited about this possibility with supersymmetry, but that's not the only possibility. As I told you before, you could also try to connect the Higgs boson with some other kind of particle, with a gauge boson, which has sort of similar properties that its quantum corrections will be naturally damped. And so if you try to connect the Higgs with the gauge boson, so that looks difficult. Both of them are bosons, so supersymmetry won't work, and you know, ordinary symmetries wouldn't want to do that for you. But the key idea is that if you actually had more than once more spatial dimensions than we observe, okay, then a gauge boson in more than our observed four dimensions, yes, would have more indices. It would have an extra index, for example, could have a 5 index here. And this fifth guy, from the point of view of four-dimensional observers, would look like a scalar. Okay, so this would go into a mu plus a 5. Okay. And this additional guy here, just from a four-dimensional observer's point of view, would look like a scalar. But secretly, you know that once you start seeing the extra dimensions, it is actually not a scalar. It is related by gauge invariance to this higher dimensional gauge field. So then the five-dimensional gauge invariance, which is on A5, which will give you A5 plus the fifth derivative of a scalar, would give you a protection of this, you know, scalar particle for larger corrections. Okay, so this shift symmetry, these theories are sometimes known as extra dimensional theories. Sometimes, you know, you can use the same shift symmetry from some four dimensional consideration and call this a little Higgs theory. And again, all of these theories would then also say that there has to be a lot of other particles. In the case of these extra dimensional theories, of course, there has to be an extra dimension, which has to be compactified. All the particles would pick up a KK tower, and you would search for those. Okay.
Question.
Yes.
What are the fundamentals of the gravitons? I heard that you get particles that are almost decoupled or some part of
it? So that's a good question. So in the version that I, in the simple, most simplistic version, yes. Now the more realistic ones that people have been thinking about, so-called warped extra-dimensional theories or Randall-Sandrum type models, there would actually be also some version of the graviton itself that could be observable. Okay, so it's not, people have different, you know, flavors of these theories, and in some of them gravity plays some role, and some of them it doesn't. Okay. Okay, very good. So let me just try to summarize. What we do know for sure is that the electroweak symmetry is broken. And the LHC is turning on. At least I hope it's for sure. Now we have a lot of speculations about the LHC is going to see. Most of us are convinced that a Higgs or something like a Higgs will be part of the results of the experiments at the LHC. And if it is really a Higgs, then as I was trying to explain to you, we think there probably has to be something else there also to stabilize it. So we think maybe plus supersymmetry, plus extra dimension, or some other way that we haven't thought about yet that we hopefully we'll be seeing very soon, maybe in a year or two. Okay, thank you very much.
As I understand, you start with massless Lagrangian, like the Maxwell, and then mass is acquired by interaction with the Higgs field. If so, why the particles get exact, stable, and mass which is like given by God, like electron and proton. If I assume somebody wise, mass propagating, it should be variable. Why it's so stable?
Oh, you mean it should be variable in space?
Whatever, in time, or right, electron and proton. So fixed mass, if they acquired it by interaction with Higgs.
So that's implied that the Higgs is, you know, has an exactly constant value everywhere. Yes. Why? Well, if it didn't, that would violate Lorentz invariance. Yes. Now, why there has to be Lorentz invariance? Well.
But if you start from a symmetric and you store in the high universe,
yes,
and come down,
yes,
then obviously things are not going to correlate over Hubble scale at the time of symmetry breaking.
Yeah, so then you have to inflation and phase transition.
But this symmetry breaking is much later than inflation or something, right? I mean,
electrobeat
symmetry.
That's right, yes.
Then won't you have different things going on in different patches of the universe?
What? Someone earlier asked about what if the Higgs was composite.
That's right.
And I don't think you answered that.
What if it's composite?
Yeah.
Well, we hope it's composite. That would be very exciting if it was composite. That would tell you that I don't have any of these problems, yes, because what is this problem with the hierarchy, yes? It's saying that, well, you know, if I have these very, very energetic particles running in the loop, then, you know, I pick up these large corrections. But of course, at very, very high energies, a composite Higgs wouldn't exist. It wouldn't be composite anymore. So there would be form factors here. So that would be a very nice solution to the same problem that actually people are thinking about. And again, in that case, you know, you would just see, you wouldn't see any of these. Maybe, you know, a version of the extra dimensional theories. Yeah, so, you know, something that is called the Technicolor type theory. Basically, we'll see another strong interaction that is making the Higgs to be a composite.
But the new scale, where beyond that, the Higgs is no more Higgs, but it's
yes,
expanded. That scale must be also very close to the...
So that scale should also be of the order of the TD scales, or a few TD scales. Yeah. So that would be another thing that you would be there looking for.
So people,
I didn't talk about all the possibilities, but that's another really interesting direction.
So the people is also expecting if Higgs is a composite object.
That's another thing that people are thinking about.
Can see that it's a more elementary object of the
exactly matter. So if they are, you know, if they are light enough, but at the very least, then you would see some form factors here. They should also turn into form factors because, you know, the Higgs is very strongly related to the W and the Z bosons. You would see some form factors turning on in the scattering of the W themselves.
One last question.
In the context of the quark potential, you talked about in LHC how a Z particle could excite a Higgs as a radial oscillation in that case.
Yes.
How much energy would it take to excite one back up onto the unstable minima such that you could inflate a vortex ring?
Well, again, you know, so you would have, in order for you to, the entire vacuum to come in, yes?
So locally up onto the unstable minima, so that locally you could inflate the vortex ring.
Again, I think that's a different question. I mean, just two particles colliding is not going to, you know, generate a patch of new vacuum for you.
Well, he's wondering if there couldn't be topological excitations.
The generation of them.
Or generate them from some collision. It's interesting.
I think people have thought about it.
Yes.
And I think the answer is, you know, you really need to go to high temperature.
To be very
and not, I think, you know, just high center of mass energy is usually not enough. That's my understanding.
It's very hard because they're multi-quanta. They're like classical. So they have many quanta. So you have a couple of elementary quanta going to produce a state with many quanta. And that's generally a very hard thing to do. There's not very much overlap between them. But people have thought about it. I think NAMBU was probably the first. Well, thanks very much, everybody.